Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Jeff Kinney, creator of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, and Dave Pilkey, creator of Captain Underpants. We'll also hear from Kara Hoffman, whose new book is Be Safe, I Love You. Jeff Kinney is one of the powerhouses of children's books, known far and wide for his Diary of a Wimpy Kid series. He started out wanting to be a newspaper cartoonist, but has certainly found his calling in his innovative and hilarious books for young readers, chronicling Greg Heffley's adventures in middle school. Time magazine named Jeff one of the 100 most influential people in the world in 2009, and it's easy to see why. He's coming to New Orleans to talk about the most recent book in the series, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Hard Luck, at the International Reading Association Convention. Jeff Kinney, welcome to The Reading Life.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. These books are just hilarious, and they're so beloved. What feedback do you get from your readers? How do you stay in touch with them?
I actually stay in touch by going out and meeting them. You know, it's a strange life that I have. I live in a small town called Plainville, Massachusetts, and that's where I am now. And I write my book. I'm full of, like, self-doubt and self-loathing as I'm trying to write a funny book. And then I put it out there in the world and go around in November and December and get to meet the kids who are waiting for what I've been working on. And it's strange every time.
You're a rock star in children's books. I would think it would get a little easier with time.
Well, you know, each time I'm like, how long are people going to keep reading these? I'm up to book 9, which sometimes seems a little bit crass in a way, but you know, I think what I've really learned about my books is that the characters aren't really literary characters, they're cartoon characters, and a good cartoon character should live forever.
Now, you have 2 sons of your own. How old are they? Are they old enough to appreciate your authorship yet?
They're 8 and 11, and, you know, sometimes my kids get a little kick out of what I do, but most of the time it doesn't really affect them. It doesn't, you know, interfere with their lives in any way, and I try to keep all the wimpy kids stuff out of the house. So as far as they're concerned, you know, I'm a regular dad, and I actually do have a regular job doing something else completely. So for them, they don't get too affected.
Now, you came to this from game design, didn't you?
Yes, and that's still my full-time job.
And how does that influence your concept of what a story should be or what a book should be? What has that rhythm done for you?
Well, actually, my writing in game design is much better than my writing in my book. In Pop Tropical, which is a virtual world that I created and work for now, we try to tell complete stories, narratives, and all sorts of different genres. But when I write a book, I actually put the priority on humor, not narrative. So I really try to write as many funny jokes as I can and then string them together into some sort of narrative. But the priority in my book is not narrative, it's jokes.
You chose one of the funniest times in life, I guess in retrospect, it's one of the funniest times in life, the middle school years. So I have to ask you, were you a wimpy kid in middle school?
I was. I was actually kind of an average kid, really, but when I was wimpy, I was very, very wimpy. I was on the swim team as a kid, for example, and my father would drop me off at practice, and then immediately after he left, I'd go down to the creek and catch tadpoles. And, you know, make my way back to the water right before he picked me up and just jump in and then, you know, and try to appear exhausted at the exertion of practice. So I did lots of things like that as a kid.
And you really target one of the hard times in Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Hard Luck, because in this book, Greg's best friend, Rowley, has a girlfriend and Greg doesn't.
Yeah, you know, I think that's just something that kids don't see coming, is that their best friend will eventually get a boyfriend, girlfriend, and their best friend will become a completely different person, you know, just absolutely nauseating. So I was really playing with that idea that Greg thinks he would be the one to get the girlfriend, but here Rowley has gotten the girlfriend first, and it's very unsettling to him.
I love Greg's incredibly true-to-life combination of confidence and extreme, you know, lack of it. I mean, it's just, there's nothing like it, and that's the way it is in middle school. The other thing I love about these books is that, in a way, they're very subversive because they encourage writing and drawing by their very existence. It's a way to get to kids that is kind of easy.
Yeah, I think so. In my latest book, Greg is very upset with getting books for his birthday. He's just devastated by this. And I remember somebody in my publishing company said, boy, you know, I don't know if that's great to speak badly of books. And I'm like, you know, the joke is that you're holding a book in your hand. You're reading a book. So I think that it's thrilling for me to see kids pick up my books, kids who weren't ordinarily big on reading, and then they read my books, and then they move on to bigger and better things. So that's great to be a gateway into reading.
Well, it's kind of wonderful that a wimpy kid can be reading a book called Diary of a Wimpy Kid with no shame whatsoever, and it's cool.
That was a big worry when I titled the book, and in fact, my publisher was worried about that, that what self-respecting kid would pick up a book called Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And it hasn't been a problem, so it's been great, actually.
So it makes Wimpy cool for at least the length of a book.
I think it does. I think in our lifetimes, we've seen the word nerd really change. You know, I think that kids who are nerdy are very proud of it, self-aware. It's not a stigma. In fact, those people end up being our bosses. So,
yes.
Know, I think it's a good thing.
Now, this is a terrible time in declining literacy rates, and you're certainly one of those writers who has made a tremendous difference, especially in getting boys to read. And one of the things you're going to be talking about at the IRA is drawing in reluctant readers. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't pretend to have done any of that on purpose. I actually wrote these books for adults. I had a totally different target audience in mind in the 8 years I was working on this series. So I'm thrilled that kids have picked up my books, that my books found their way into kids' hands. But that was not the intended outcome.
But they've responded to them so well. What is it that you do to keep it fresh for yourself as a writer?
Whenever I start a new book, I see it as a challenge and an obligation in a way. I think, wow, there's millions of kids who are going to read whatever I write, and that's very motivating. I want to do my best job because I know I have an audience. And I also don't know when the ride will end for me, so I want to make sure I don't drop the ball. But to keep it fresh, I just try to give the characters different situations to be in. For example, this new book is about a road trip, and that's something I haven't done before, so that's keeping it fresh for me. And I think that's the challenge of any mature property, if you will, is how to keep surprising your audience.
And you've also made that transition to film, which can sometimes go either way, you know, for a writer. How did you feel about the film version?
Well, I learned a lot during the filming of these movies. I learned that you have to speak a completely different language to tell a satisfying story in a theater than you do between the pages of a book. You know, you have to tell a story that is really emotionally satisfying and pays off for the audience member. Whereas in a book, I can be very arch. You know, I can end the book in a way that's maybe very unconventional. But in film, you have to tell a story that's really going to speak to the heart.
And I know you are so good at slipping in those humorous little nuggets for parents. We've been talking with Jeff Kinney, who is known and loved as the creator of Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Jeff will be appearing, along with Dave Pilkey, creator of the Captain Underpants series, Friday, May 9th at 6 p.m. at Metairie Park Country Day School as part of an event sponsored by Octavia Books and Country Day. Tickets to the event are available at Octavia Books or their website, octaviabooks.com. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Dave Pilkey has made millions of young readers and their parents laugh with his best-selling Captain Underpants books. Let's face it, there are just some book titles you can't say without laughing. He's up to 10 now in the series, and the most recent is Captain Underpants and the Revolting Revenge of the Radioactive Robo-Boxers. And he's also created the Ricky Ricotta series featuring a mouse and his robot buddy, as well as the Dumb Bunnies. Dave lives on Bainbridge Island in Washington part of the year and part of the year in Japan. He's coming to New Orleans to be one of the keynote speakers for the International Reading Association meeting here in May. Dave Pilkey, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be here.
I'm so happy to talk to you. When my kids were young and I was a storytelling witch every Halloween, one of my greatest pleasures was reading The Halloweener. So thank you for that book. Now, you've struggled with dyslexia and ADHD yourself, so I know you have a special feeling for young readers who are having trouble finding their way into books.
Yeah, that's true. When I was a kid, I had a lot of problems with reading, and it's unfortunate because it's almost like being picked last at sports, but it's with reading, and it can be really devastating, and it can be really hard on the kid's self-esteem. And so having those experiences as a kid worked out for me because now I write the kind of books that I would have liked to read when I was a kid.
And you work very hard to make reading fun for kids, don't you?
Yeah, for me, reading was always kind of like a punishment. Someone would hand me a book and I would be like, well, what did I do wrong? But I really want to give kids the idea that reading doesn't have to be a chore. It can actually be fun. It can be something that's completely enjoyable.
You have that wonderful gift of, you know, you can be your own writer and illustrator, and that's not true for a lot of children's book authors. So how did you come up with these two, with George and Harold, and the whole idea of Captain Underpants?
Well, Captain Underpants was kind of inspired by a teacher of mine that I had when I was in second grade. She used the word underwear in class one time, and everyone just started laughing. She got really angry, and she told us all to settle down. And I realized at that moment that underwear is a really powerful thing. It makes everyone laugh. And so I think it was that day that I started drawing Captain Underpants. And George and Harold are kind of based on myself when I was a kid. They're sort of misfits. They have ADHD, and they have some problems in school getting along with the authorities. And that was definitely my childhood.
So the kid inside you remains alive and well, eh?
Yes, I think so, yes.
And your books are such a punchy combination of the verbal and the visual. I mean, it's so interesting now you're doing Captain Underpants in full color.
That's right, yeah. They're being transported into full color by someone else, but it's really fun to see them come to life that way.
And you like having books do things, like the cheesy Flipperama pages.
Yeah, I think it opens up a new dimension to kids, or it actually makes the books like something that you can actually play with. Books can be kind of scary a lot of times for little kids. They can be intimidating. And I think that takes away a lot of it. If you're playing with a book and you're flipping pages back and forth to animate them, it actually becomes really fun.
It's something you use and bend and, you know, move with. I think that's really great. But these books have also been controversial, haven't they?
Yeah, the American Library Association released their list of the most banned books and most controversial books. And Captain Underpants, once again, was number one on the list.
And how does that make you feel?
A little disappointed, I think, because as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing really offensive in it. There's no more violence than you'd find in a Superman cartoon. And there's no sex, there's no alcohol, there's no drugs, there's no profanity. So it's really confusing to me why they'd be on that list. And I worry that sometimes parents might see that list and they might not want their kids to read the book because they had a chance to check them out themselves.
Well, sometimes I think maybe it makes the kids want to read the books more. And you know you have the support of the librarians out there, too.
Yeah, it is actually very nice. I think one of the things that most people don't focus on when a book is banned or challenged is that the challenge will often go to the school board, and parents and teachers and librarians have a chance to talk about the book and to discuss its merits. And a lot of parents, teachers, and librarians have used these books successfully for almost 20 years. We'll stand up for the book and we'll pick up for the book. And most of the time, the books are not removed from the shelves.
And you're going to talk about your ADHD and dyslexia struggles, aren't you, at the IRA?
Yes, that's right.
You're one of the keynote speakers. That's a particularly powerful audience to speak to, of reading teachers and librarians. So what is the most important thing you have to tell them, you think?
Well, one of the things I really wanted to focus on was just the way that reading can be such a struggle for so many kids. It was such a hard thing for me. And I think as adults, we sometimes forget how hard it is to learn to read. And it can really kind of mess with a child's perception of themselves. And so I really want to focus on that. And I'm not an expert at anything when it comes to reading, and I'm not a teacher, and I'm not even a parent, but I'm a former kid who struggled with reading. And I hope that it'll be good for librarians to hear from someone who had so many problems as a kid.
And I think that makes you a more powerful witness for, you know, what books can do in a life. One of the things that was so interesting to me is that you did this wonderful video about living in Japan part of the year where you don't know the language and getting to know some young kids there and how you got to communicate with them.
Oh, that's true, yeah. I don't speak hardly any Japanese. In the area that my wife and I live in Japan, almost no one speaks English. And so if you want to communicate, you have to sort of find other ways to communicate. And I think that opened up a lot of opportunities for me in my book, especially in my latest book, where I told an entire story in one chapter without using words.
I know. It's got to be fun to do a wordless kind of picture book within a book.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that I really do think is important for reading, especially kids who are getting out of picture books and going into chapter books. A lot of times the pictures just disappear. And for kids who are having struggles with reading, it can be very unfortunate to open up a book and not see any pictures. And that was one of the things that when I was a child and I had so much trouble with reading, I was always looking for books that had lots and lots of illustrations. And that's one of the things that influenced me as a writer today. I always have a picture on every page just to make the experience of reading less intimidating.
And you've stepped aside from the illustrating part of it with the Ricky Ricotta series. Ricky Ricotta's Mighty Robot. These are incredibly beautiful books in their own way. You know, they make robots really gorgeous. What's it like for you to work with an illustrator after having filled that role yourself?
It's a lot of fun, actually, to be able to work with Dan Pantat. He's an amazing illustrator, and he took over the responsibilities of illustrating Ricky Ricotta's Mighty Robot, and he's phenomenal. As you mentioned, his artwork is so beautiful, and to me, it's a real honor to be able to work with somebody who's that talented.
And he'll be coming with you. He'll be here at the IRA as well.
That's
so
right.
It's going to be a fun-filled week for lovers of children's books. We're so excited you're coming. And it's been such a privilege to talk to you. We've been talking with Dave Pilkey, who is the creator of the Captain Underpants series. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you, Susan.
Kara Hoffman teaches writing and literature at Bronx Community College and lives in New York City. Her first novel, So Much Pretty, with its portrayal of domestic abuse and small-town women's lives, was an impressive debut. And her second novel, Be Safe, I Love You, is a harrowing portrait of a returning war veteran from Iraq. Kara Hoffman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thank you.
Now, in your portrait of Lauren Clay, you give us a woman in full, really. She's served her family, served her country, fought for her education and her family, and almost all of this at the price of her one precious talent. It is an amazingly complex, rich picture of this woman's life. How did this evolve for you over time? How did you decide to take on returning war veterans?
Good question. I come from a military family, and so I have been around a lot of veterans my whole life. My mother's entire family, all of her brothers served in the military, and my grandfather, and then my brother also when he was 18 enlisted. So it's something that's very, very close to me personally. I think a lot of people may not have realized I never really talked about it, honestly never really thought about it that much until my brother was deployed to Afghanistan. He did 2 tours of duty in Afghanistan.
And you focus a lot on the cost of war for women in this book, not just the women who are veterans, but kind of all women.
Right. The thing I think that's important about the book is that it's not just a war story. It's actually about how war affects everyone, that it's very much something that affects whole families, that there's exponentially more people involved in someone, say, having a diagnosis of PTSD or someone being wounded or someone being gone or the fear of what could be happening to your loved one. It's a whole community of people that are involved in those things. And I think war stories generally have focused on maybe the story of one rugged individual going into battle or doing something or experience something. And my book is different in that it's really taking into account a whole system of things.
And it's about a different kind of violence. It's about the consequences of violence.
Indeed. I think what's important about the book is that it offers a different perspective than just showing one person's experience with violence. And in this case, it shows what the consequences are of having perpetrated violence and living with that, which I think many soldiers do have to face.
And the other thing about your books that fascinates me is that you sort of staked out these small towns in upstate New York as your territory, you know, and you show how the military's reach can overtake an entire town.
Well, in the case of Watertown, it is a base town.
Mm-hmm.
So it very literally does overtake the culture of a town. If you have a military base in a particular place, it's going to affect the culture. But also, you know, this is where the majority of people who are enlisting are coming from. They're coming from places that are economically impoverished. They're coming from backgrounds where they don't have a lot. They're making a decision to enlist, but that decision is often based on not having too many other choices, not having the choice to get an education, not having been brought up with the kind of privileges that other people have.
And so much of it's motivated by the hope for a better life eventually.
Mm-hmm.
After you get through the really terrible thing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
there's a hope that things will get better.
I think the character Lauren Clay, I think all of her actions actually are motivated by a hope for something to be better. She enlists because she wants to help her family. She wants her little brother. She's very close to her little brother, and she wants so badly for him to have a life that she didn't have and that really nobody in her family had. And she also wants for him to see beautiful things and to experience beauty as something that can transcend and lift him out of the sort of dank, upstate, rural poverty that they live in.
And he's a fascinating little boy. I wonder if you talk a little bit about him, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Danny. It seems like everybody really loves the character of Danny Clay. So it's Lauren's little brother, and he is very, very interested in Arctic exploration, which became a topic for him when he was young. And now she returns home from the war, and Danny is 13 years old, and he's still very interested in Arctic exploration. But he's kind of succumbed to a lot of pop culture things, and he really sort of lives a life online, and he doesn't really have much of a life, and she wants to bring him out of that and take him on this adventure, and of course that ends up becoming actually the harrowing adventure, I think.
Yes,
story
yes.
Is she essentially kidnaps him. You know, I grew up with brothers, obviously. I had an older brother and a younger brother, and, you know, felt very close to them, and I feel like that sibling relationship is reflected in the book, and it's very strong and immediate.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's another little bit of your own experience that you draw from in creating Lauren, and that's, you know, she is a fabulous singer, and you study voice as well.
I did, yeah, I did. I wanted to put that in there not just because I studied voice, but I think because people don't really have a sense of the totality of what people in the military, what soldiers are like, and I think a lot of the times they sort of stereotype and think, oh, you know, this is their sole interest or they couldn't do anything else. But there's plenty of musicians and artists and writers and folks like that who serve in the military, so I wanted that to be there. And yeah, and I studied voice and studied classical music, and so it was pretty easy for me to put those details in and to understand what it feels like.
Well, I know that your writing has been described as making poetry out of pain, but I have to think that writing those really beautiful passages about her singing and her love of music must have been a great relief and counterpoint for you after writing those painful, painful passages about war.
It was. It was a real pleasure because the book is heavy, and it's heavy having to do with the war, and it's also heavy having to do with family relationships and, you know, what it means to be separated from your family and what it means to be abandoned by a parent, things like this. So being able to write about music and being able to write particularly about sacred music, holy minimalist music, which I think is so, so beautiful, was completely elevating for me as a writer. And you know, from what I'm hearing from readers, I think it's gone over pretty well.
That's a wonderful thing. We've been talking with Kara Hoffman, whose amazing second novel is Be Safe, I Love You. You can meet her at Octavia Books Tuesday, May 6th at 6 p.m. Thank you so much, Kara.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Richard Sexton discusses Ensign's Creole World, photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean sphere, Tuesday, April 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Novelist Roy Hoffman signs Come Landfall, Wednesday, April 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bill Hillman signs his novel, The Old Neighborhood, and Ben Tanzer signs his essay collection, Lost in Space, A Father's Journey There and Back Again, Wednesday, April 30th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Ryan Holiday signs The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph, Monday, May 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Charles Robert March signs Strange Glory, A Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Monday, May 5th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Kara Hoffman, discusses and signs Be Safe, I Love You, Tuesday, May 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bill Lofelm discusses and signs the paperback edition of The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, May 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet, painter, and book artist Afton Wilkie, author of Clarity Speaks of a Crystal Sea, is the featured reader at 1718 Reading Series, sponsored by Tulane Loyola and University of New Orleans students, Tuesday, May 6th at 7 at the Collins Hotel. Coming up at the Jazz Fest book tent this weekend, Thursday, May 1st is Locals Day. I'll be signing The Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans from noon to 1. Bill Lofelm signs The Devil in Her Way from 2 to 3. Bonnie Warren, New Orleans Historic Homes from 3 to 4. And Michael Murphy, Eat Dat New Orleans, A Guide to the Unique Food Culture of the Crescent City from 4 to 5. Friday, May 2nd, Richard Sexton signs Creole World from noon to 1. Cornell Landry, Happy Jazz Fest from 1 to 2. Diane de las Casas and Kid Chef Eliana signs Cinderelephant and Cool Kids Cook, Fresh and Fit, from 3 to 4. Ed Branley signs New Orleans Jazz from 4 to 5. Saturday, May 3rd, Rob Owen signs Spyboy, Cheyenne, and 96 Crayons from noon to 1. Poppy Tooker signs Louisiana Eats from 1 to 2. And Rebecca Snedeker signs Unfathomable City from 3 to 4. Sunday, May 4th, Sally Asher signs Hope and New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names from noon to 1. And John Ed Downing signs How to Dress a Po' Boy from 2 to 3. And after Jazz Fest, there are lots of events coming up in May. The International Reading Association meets here May 10th through 12th at the Morial Convention Center. Watch for lots of great author signings around town. Also, if you're interested in attending, day passes are available. Check out iraconference.org. Saints and Sinners, the literary festival for LGBT writers and friends, will be held at the Hotel Monteleone May 13th through 18th. There's a great roster of speakers, including Carol Anshaw, Greg Herron, Andrew Holleran, and Edmund White. For information, check out sasfest.org. Romantic Times is holding its annual conference here as well, May 14th through 18th at the Marriott on Canal Street. Watch for hundreds of romance writers, including E.L. James of 50 Shades of Grey fame. Check out rtconvention.com for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.